Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting novelist Ben Lerner for a closer look at and reading from his latest and most excellent book, The Topeka School.
Then we'll be meeting Art on the Underground head Eleanor Pinfield and the artist Larry Achimpong to discover more about the ongoing project to turn the arteries of London's transport network into a gallery.
That's all coming up. Plus, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Look, here we are. Lovely to have us both in the studio. Lovely to see you. Sunday lunchtime. Where else would you rather be? Nowhere.
Definitely not the pub.
I'm looking forward to the guests you've booked for today's programme. They sound great. Art on the Underground. It's been going for a while. What are they doing? Well, I suppose we'll figure out what they're doing.
I think it's been going for quite a long time, you know, since the early noughties, as we now call them, those golden days.
Golden days.
I think it's such a fantastic project. I don't take public transport around London anymore because I'm deathly afraid of contracting norovirus.
Okay.
So I cycle instead. But when I was a regular user, I often used to think about what a kind of beautiful position, what a beautiful role Art on the Underground occupied in relation to transport and to people who use the underground. And I thought it's almost utopian, which is not a word that you often use in the same sentence as London. What have you been up to this week, Rob?
I've been rattling in on the Bakerloo line, as is my not wont. Yeah, and finishing off the forecast, which we closed yesterday. A little bit of an early morning here in the Monocle magazine office, but that's been patted on the bum and sent on its way to the printers. And don't make that face. That's a fine thing. That's okay to say that. Surely. What?
Yeah, we'll stick that in there.
The forecast is not a gendered product. It's just a piece of paper.
What is the forecast? How's the weather looking?
It's going to be very stormy in 2020. Anyway, let's not both get sacked before we've even introduced Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I see you straining at the leash to come in and tell us about next week's news. There was something.
Here he is, Fernando. Phil, welcome.
Hello, how are you guys? By the way, I do like the Bakerloo line. You know, I don't take the metro every day, but, you know, it's one of my favourite lines. Or the Jubilee as well. Just a little.
Jubilee fast and clean, a little bit soulless.
We have some important news this week. Actually, starting today, a general election in Spain. I know you might ask again. Yes, it's the fourth election in 4 years. And the only worrying thing here is, of course, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez from the Socialist Party. He called this election because he couldn't form a government. But if you look at the polls, it's going to be more or less the same result. In fact, I think he's polling a little bit less than he did in the previous election. So I wonder if Spain will manage to form a government this time as well. They might have to have a fifth election in 4 years. And it's very fragmented. They had a debate, you know, the five main candidates, all main candidates. And also Santiago Abascal from Vox, from the far-right party, is doing well. So it's very much fragmented, especially after the anti-independence protests as well. That's the only thing. I don't see, like, a result coming out of this election. I might be wrong. Let's see what's going to be on TV.
You don't really say watch this space, don't we? But maybe we don't need to. We just sort of, like, turn the tombola around one more time. Like a kind of school fate next year.
See who rumbles out.
But
if I may say about Pedro Sanchez, I think he's I like how composed he is. And he's also very tall, a former basketball player.
Oh, the two most important criteria for heads of state.
Exactly.
There. Where are we going next?
Well, a little bit softer, the topic of magazines. I know, Og, you visited the Mac Culture Live this week for the Stack, and I thank you very much for that. You met a lot of interesting editors. And I think one of the people who spoke was James Hughes from FIP. FIP is where top editors and publishers, they meet in a city once every year. It depends. I've been to one of their events in London, actually. But this time it's going to be in Las Vegas at Planet Hollywood. Our very own Tyler Brulé will be there. He's one of more than 60 speakers. He's one of the main speakers, of course, I must add. There's not only editors. You see the behind the scenes. You know, we talk about circulation, the numbers. I think the CEO of YouTube is going to be there. People from National Geographic, from Meredith Publishers. And it's very international as well. So people from all the continents, in a way. That's why they do in one city every single year.
It's an interesting thing, I always think, since, you know, digital took such a bite out of traditional print, how Prince kind of come together and has been quick to have these events where they quickly went, actually, if we don't kind of share a bit of knowledge here, well, they would have been tearing strips off each other 25 years ago. And now it's kind of nice to see that it's a bit more of a, sort of sad, but nice to see that it's more of a collegiate industry. Do you know what I mean? Where people are happy to share distribution, share kind of tips and tricks and all the rest of it. Power to their elbow.
I would like to be there in Las Vegas. But on the 15th of November, though, this Friday, is, don't worry, this is not actually the main news, but it's the release of the new Charlie's Angels. But I decided to choose this to complain a little bit with Hollywood because, you know, I don't mind a nice big blockbuster, but I think they are rehashing old kind of franchise. But in a bad way. Listen, I do love a good blockbuster, but look what they did with Terminator Dark Fate. It's been a massive flop. There was no public interest for it in a way. So, and I wonder why Hollywood keep trying. I mean, they had two Terminators in the last 5 years. Again, didn't do very well. They might lose money. I was like, I think they should be perhaps a little bit cleverer with that. They should have their own World Congress to discuss those issues.
Exactly, exactly. Like they'd share anything. Who's in the new Charlie's Angels?
Well, it's going to be Kirsten Stewart, Naomi Scott, and Ella Balinska. Listen, I've seen the trailer. The soundtrack is fun. But, you know, the previous one with Cameron Diaz, I thought it was quite cool, actually.
I'm a Diaz, Barrymore, and Lou, Charlie's Angels fan.
Because the original TV show was really not very good. And that movie that Org just mentioned, the one that we all kind of, that was pretty good.
It's great.
Frothy, fun, sexy, good stuff.
Yeah.
But the original TV show, despite the wonderful haircuts, pretty bad.
A bit boring.
Yeah, very boring. Although with a really psychedelic, sort of drugged out soundtrack. Which
is a bit fun.
Which is a bit fun.
I think actually Diaz, Barrymore and Lou, they should come back and do their own version of Charlie's Angels, you know?
They're hardly over the hump, are they?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, that's my little criticism of Hollywood here.
Well, that's good. Well, hopefully your words will be ringing in their ears. Their reddened ears.
Yeah, they should feel chastised.
Thanks, Faye, and you are listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Ben Lerner as he talks language, violence, and Trump in the Topeka school. Novelist and poet Ben Lerner has received widespread acclaim for his books Leaving the Atocha Station and 1004. In 2015, at the age of 36, his efforts were recognised with the MacArthur Genius Grant for his rigorous, humorous and powerful investigations of language, humour and the boundaries between fact and fiction.
Lerner is no stranger to autobiography, drawing heavily from his own life for material. His latest novel, The Topeka School, is perhaps his most personal yet. It follows a champion debater and young poet, Adam Gordon, as he toggles between an intellectual family and a hyper-macho Midwestern hometown, layering humour, pathos and critique to paint a stunning portrait of masculinity in crisis and the anger of white America.
All caught up with Ben to learn more about the Topeka School, but first, Ben gave a short reading from the book.
My research definitely played a role in what Jane and I still call my Ziegler episode. Instead of ingesting a mysterious pill found in a museum, we dropped some of Aaron's acid, sugar dissolving in our mouths on the crosstown bus, and went to the Met. It was late January, the city a mess of dirty snow, pedestrians walking with their heads down against the wind. We checked our heavy coats, ascended the grand staircase, and wandered into the galleries of medieval painting. Tempera on wood, gold ground, elongated angels and virgins, livid Christs. At first everything struck me as a little silly. The solemnity of the guards, the bombast of the wall texts, the babies who looked like little old men nursing at breasts that jut out of the virgin's shoulders. Then we arrived before Duccio's Madonna and Child, where we stood for several minutes, my jaw clenching and unclenching involuntarily as we looked. Old paintings usually bored me. This one stopped me cold. The foreknowledge in the woman's expression, as though she could anticipate a distant recurrence, the weird parapet beneath the figures, how it linked the sacred world with the world of the viewers. One instance, I saw the gold background as flat, and another I saw depths. But what really fascinated me, really moved me, wasn't in the painting. It was how the bottom edge of the original frame was marked by candle burns, traces of an older medium of illumination, the shadow of devotion. The wall text claimed the painting helped inaugurate the Renaissance because Duccio reimagined the Madonna and Christ in terms taken from life, so in that sense it was a move against the sacred, a step toward paintings becoming objects of aesthetic contemplation, detached from religion, detached from altars, free or doomed to circulate in museums and the marketplace. but the burns were like the fingerprints of an older time, before Ziegler and his brethren decided that traditional sources of value were merely superstition. Those thousands of generations of technical progress obliterated ritual, emptied out all meaning, glossolalia without divinity. I decided that's what the painted mother foresaw, that she was saying farewell to candlelight, that she knew she was trapped inside a painting addressed to the future, where it could only be, however great, an instance of technique. New cracks spread across the surface as I stared. Tears start in my memory. We left the galleries of paintings and walked back down the staircase to find the ancient sculptures which Jane loved. When we arrived in the skylit hall, I discovered that I'd somehow absorbed the colors from the paintings and could project them now onto the smooth marble of the statuary or let them play across the museum's high walls. I was a kind of magic lantern. I described this pleasant hallucination to Jane, who seemed to be tripping not at all, and she told me in what I called her Barnard voice that Roman marble sculptures had been vividly colored, that the image of pure classical form we inherited from the Renaissance was false. There was elaborate polychromatic painting, gilding, silvering, inlay, and these sculptures would have had eyes, Jane explained to me, not smooth vacant spaces, but lifelike organs of sight constructed separately out of quartz and obsidian and set into the sockets, blue or green irises, jet black pupils. As Jane described them, the eyes materialized in 100 marble heads, and soon the court was a vast network of crisscrossing gazes encaged by them, like those laser motion sensors you see in heist movies. I could sense whenever I passed through one of the Roman sight lines an almost imperceptible pressure on my face, like walking through mist or a succession of tiny webs.
Fantastic reading. Let's just jump straight in. You've said that you're a poet first, and that you're anti-buildings Roman. And I wonder, with the publication of the Topeka School, how true that still holds.
Yeah, I mean, at first, I was an accidental novelist. And the first novel I was writing, I was really resistant to the idea that I was writing a novel. And then I thought, okay, if you're a poet, you get to write one novel. That's like the rule, a poet's novel. And I thought I'd never write another, but this trilogy kind of grew around poetry and concerns of poetry, a kind of fictional frame around some thinking I was doing about poetry. At this point, I don't know anymore. I mean, the good idea about working in more than one medium is you can take an idea and treat each genre as a laboratory in which to experiment with it. So I think poetry remains the core for me because that's kind of where my reading was first and where my heroes are and my friends are to a certain extent. But at this point, there's no denying that I'm a novelist.
We just had that lovely reading. I wondered what your reflections are on how a passage of prose changes when it's read versus a poem.
You mean when it's read aloud?
When it's read aloud.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think one thing is that for me, poetry kind of takes place against a backdrop of silence in a different way. Like felt silence is really constitutive of the art. And in prose, that's a little different to me. It's more the prosody of the sentence and the way one sentence links up with another. I don't know. I mean, this novel I've barely read aloud from, so I'm still kind of figuring out how to do it. And it's really hard to excerpt because it depends so much on kind of repetition and the way, say, like that Duccio painting is going to come back in the minds of different characters. But I think it's like some, I think a lot of poetry for me, the affect or the pathos, the emotion is in the hesitation or the felt silence. And in prose, it's a little bit different for me. But that's a good question. I don't really know. I mean, when I'm writing poems, I always read them out loud many times while I'm working on them. Prose, I often compose in silence. But that also means that it has a different relationship to actual felt silence, like at the end of a line.
There's an experience that the protagonist of the book, Adam, has when he's quite young, where he has this encounter with a nonsense poem, I Never Saw a Purple Cow.
Yeah.
And he has this realization while he's thinking about it of poems as spells. Mm-hmm. And I suppose when we're talking about reading aloud and thinking about poetry as a kind of spell or an incantation, does prose lack that power?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think there is many millennia long idea that poetry has a kind of incantatory power, a kind of magical thinking about language. I guess I locate that in prose. I do kind of have that superstitious feeling about prose too, but it's kind of less in the reading of it. It's less in the utterance of it and more that like I kind of feel like when you write a fiction, it becomes true in a certain way. You have to inhabit the world you make up. So that they're both kind of dangerous magical practices in that regard, but I do think that poetry is a little bit more about the pressurized utterance, and prose has more of an expanse where it's the story you tell that may or may not become real. It's interesting, in the book, both Adam Gordon, the protagonist, and his opposite and double at the same time, this character Darren, both really believe in magical thinking and are really worried about what language will bring about, whether it's like Adam worrying that he's going to give himself migraines if he thinks the wrong thought, or Darren's use of childhood spells to try to repel bullying. Like we have the, I don't know if this is as common for British kids as it is in America, but they teach you at a young age, if you're teased, to say that sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, which always struck me as a really interesting kind of poem to arm a kid with, because it's obviously false, right? Like if it were true, you wouldn't need the spell to cast back against the people who are wounding you with words. But like, what a weird thing. You go to a teacher and you say, so-and-so is teasing me and it hurts. And they say, well, here's the spell you can cast back to try to block the pain of the language. So children, poets, all of us to a certain degree are invested in this idea that language has an incantatory power.
And there aren't many places where that more primordial almost sense of its power breaks through, are there? Mm-hmm. You know, the playground. And as you say, they both do have this kind of this revelation of how it operates. And one of the things that struck me about that was this feeling that I sort of remember having without remembering what about, mm-hmm. but this kind of sense that as a child, you realize things that you can't articulate. Mm-hmm. You don't have the toolkit or the, mm-hmm. the linguistic toolkit to articulate at the time. And I wondered about how you pass those revelations as you grow up, mm-hmm. whether the way that you articulate them is by excavating them mm-hmm. with memory and analyzing them. Or, you know, for Adam, is it a gradual process where as his lexicon kind of grows, mm-hmm. he matures, he begins to realize retrospectively what that revelation was?
You know, there's this interesting kind of research into kids. I mean, it's been around for a long time. Like Roman Jakobson used to study it about how when you're a baby, you can make a range of vocal sounds that you actually lose once you learn an actual language. So that acquiring a language isn't just the acquisition of new knowledge. It's also losing something, which is a capacity to potentially speak every language, to make every available vocal sound. And I think part of what this book is kind of interested in is the way you get interpolated into a language, like the way that you, and when you assimilate yourself to one language, the language of a father or the language of a real man, whatever that is, or the language of, you know, a profession, whatever, like you also lose something. You lose this childlike capacity to be kind of adrift amid all these different potential languages. So I think part of what's happening in this book is that there are kind of two Adams. There's the Adam who's the adolescent in Topeka, class of 1997 at Topeka High School. And there's the older Adam who's kind of remembering and writing the book, who's now a father with two little girls who are in their process of acquiring language. And I think that the book is trying to remember the plasticity of language, like those moments where your linguistic identity hadn't yet solidified, and how there was both potential and peril and those moments of indeterminacy, because on the one hand, it could be really vertiginous, like who am I and what is my language? And on the other hand, you hadn't yet become one kind of speaker or one kind of person. So I think one of the things literature can do is try to restore our sense of wonder before language as such. Not just speak a particular language, but just be amazed by the fact that we make these vibrating columns of air that we can send out over the radio or whatever that make part of consciousness shareable. So in this book, which is really organized around these theaters of extreme speech, like language breaking down under trauma, or, you know, language breaking down when you're tripping at a museum, or language breaking down because Adam has this horrible concussion, or this fast high school debate in which language starts to crumble under speed. Those are all moments to a certain degree of linguistic collapse, and they're kind of terrifying, but they're also moments of potential renovation, of like remembering the miracle, the mundane miracle of language as such. But I think kids have that sense of language as plastic, as unformed, as malleable.
We've spoken about prose and the power of fiction. Famously, your books hew kind of between fact and fiction. Mm-hmm. There are autobiographical qualities. Mm-hmm. And shame is something that you interrogate. Mm-hmm. I wondered how you process it whether writing allows you to kind of metabolize shame and guilt, whether it's almost like a selfish mm-hmm. kind of act of analysis, mm-hmm. or whether that's not the case, whether you come away from having mm-hmm. remembered something awful with just as much shame as you had when you went into it.
That's interesting. I mean, shame is a really great theme of the novel traditionally, because shame is in part about exposing the disconnect between your internal experience and the social world, right? Like, shame is when, like, you're trying to pass yourself off as one thing and you get caught and revealed to be another thing. And to a certain degree, that's like the most traditional novelistic concern, because what the novel can do really well is depict the relationship between an individual consciousness and society generally. To a certain degree, I think shame is a great theme of the novel. I was really influenced by my friend Aaron Kunyon, who used to tell me that, like, you should always use the stuff you're most embarrassed about as material for art. He didn't explain why, but it immediately made sense to me. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Like, I'm trying to think about what I feel most shameful in the, I mean, I think that my first novel, Leaving the Atocha Station, did try to kind of transform something I was ashamed about into something I could be really interested in, which was, I used to be really anxious, especially as a kid, that I wasn't having, like, authentic aesthetic experiences. Like, here I was claiming to be an artist, but, like, I was never moved enough by this or that. And so I kind of had made that into, like, you know, the narrator of that novel is like an exaggerated version of that concern. But I felt like, in fact, like, that embarrassment or that anxiety about what constitutes an authentic aesthetic experience is actually a really interesting subject for art. So I guess I did feel I was transforming something I felt like ashamed about. It was something I felt like was my shameful relation to art, and I tried to make it material for art and contemplation. So I probably did feel, in a sense, less ashamed after I kind of metabolized that. But I generally think a lot of art is made when your resistance to something is made part of the project, you know? This book is different because it's more personal and psychologically complex, dealing with family history and stuff. I was telling my wife about this. Like, I've been, like, walking around the house being like, who shared all these, like, personal stories about the family? You know, and, like, now the New York Times is writing about when I was a kid and wrapped my penis in gum. Like, and then I would be like, oh, wait, I did it. I'm the one who wrote the book and, like, did the profile or whatever. So I think it's more like I re-encounter. There's still, like, plenty of shame. But there is something about the transformation of experience into a patterned work of art, which involves a lot of fiction, which lends it not a dignity. It's not that it's less shameful. It just, in externalizing it, it does give you some kind of different perspective about it. Yeah, so I don't know. But there's something, like, really interestingly just, like, shameful about writing generally. I mean, I've devoted my life to it, right? Like, it's not like I don't think it's worthwhile, but it is kind of, like, being a poet is a very embarrassing thing. I mean, I wrote about this in this monograph called The Hatred of Poetry, right? It's like a kind of Peter Pan. It's like, why haven't you grown up and joined the real world? Do you think your feelings are more important than other people's feelings? So I guess the way I would summarize it is to say that I think shame, anxiety, a lot of those ugly feelings are always really involved in our relationship to the arts, and that I also think they're interesting material for art. And a lot of my favorite writing is, to one extent or another, about shame.
Mm. I mean, I think what's interesting that came up there is that embarrassment is, like, often very, very funny for other people.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned the bit where you or Adam or whoever wraps your penis in gum.
No, that was me. That was true. that part's totally not
really funny. And there's even something quite funny about the idea that you're fretting, that you're experiencing shame because your lifestyle isn't sufficiently, it's not authentically arty enough. But then there are other types of shame. You know, there's this masculinity in the book that Adam is very much a part of, this kind of peer group that sort of venerates weightlifting, mm-hmm. fighting, mm-hmm. rapping, mm-hmm. which in itself is an inauthentic connection to an art form. And that shame, a participation in a set of behaviors mm-hmm. that one knows that one should mm-hmm. have known better than at the time, which is clearly the case for Adam, and I think maybe a lot of mm-hmm. people have experienced. That seems more acute.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really easy, Like, if you take, like, the example of, like, the white kids rapping, like, the white middle-class kids in Kansas in the 90s who are basically mimicking gangster rap, which has no relevance to their life, I mean, except that they're increasingly nihilistic in their violence, but it's this spectacularized image of African-American violence that they've largely produced by buying records. You know, I mean, Midwestern white kids were the biggest purchasers of kind of gangster rap records or whatever. Like, that's an example of something that's really clearly embarrassing or shameful. You know, it's part of a long history of appropriation. It's kind of hilarious and ugly to look at in a certain way. The risk that the book wants to take is not just to make fun of and disavow, say, the white kids freestyling, but to also even find in that busted form of cultural appropriation little moments of experience of flow or linguistic possibility that it can also celebrate. So, like, I think it's very easy to write from a certain vantage and to disavow the shameful. And I think what's more complicated and important is to both, like, really acknowledge the degree to which it's part of one's experience and part of the genealogy of one's voice, and to ruthlessly critique it, but to also find the little glimmers of possibility. So I think there's, like, a lot of writing right now, or a lot of noise right now, where you have, like, a lot of white guys, for example, disavowing everything that's wrong about whiteness and masculinity or whatever. But it doesn't work that way. It's not so easy to just disavow, right? The harder thing to do is to figure out how it persists within you. So, like, I'm trying to do this thing when, like, you know, when we watched the Kavanaugh hearings, the Supreme Court hearings in the U.S., and there was just this shrill indignance. There was just this kind of, how dare anyone accuse me during my ascent to the Supreme Court? You know, I deserve this. This is my privilege. This is my birthright kind of talk. It's really easy to just say that's really disgusting and I disavow it. And it is really disgusting and it should be disavowed. But it also should cause people to reflect, white men of a certain class, on what part of that, like, shrill indignation is within them and part of their voice. So on the one hand, I guess I'm saying, like, to really interrogate the history of shameful behavior is to actually figure out how it persists within you on the one hand, something like the Kavanaugh shrill indignation I'm talking about. On the other stuff, where it's, like, easy to mock the white kids freestyling, it's about being ruthless about what was, you know, messed up about the cultural appropriation, or what was hilarious, or what was, you know, embarrassing about it. But then to also look at moments like that and not just negate them, but to think about, like, that was kind of interesting too, that there were all these 16-year-old white kids who were trying to make rhymes, you know, even though they didn't have their own vocabulary in which to do it. So I just mean, it's like, staying with the shame, staying with the trouble, staying with the negative figures of possibility that are in the shameful practice, all of that, I feel like, is the risky, difficult territory the art has to undertake.
It seems like a lot of this discourse around the disavows of shrillness, that kind of Kavanaugh thing, a lot of it takes place online, a lot of it takes place on Twitter, and that is not an environment that lends itself to nuance.
No.
This kind of criticality. One of the things that struck me in this, and also in 1004, which is your previous novel, well, in 1004, the narrator, who's Ben, has an encounter with a protester who he is part of the Occupy movement. He invites back to his flat for a wash, for whatever. And the protester starts talking about the way that he's been trying to come to terms with this feeling he has, which is whenever he meets another man, his first thought is, could I beat this guy in a fight? There's a lot of violence. I mean, there's not a lot of violence in a Bret Easton Ellis way. There's like, there's violence in this book. And a lot of it, strikingly, is directed at men. There's one notable incident where that's not the case. But for the most part, it's directed at men. And I wondered what your reflections are on this kind of male-on-male violence, which never seems to be discussed as a gendered issue. For obvious reasons, violence against women is given primacy in discourses. But do you think it's something that is under-evaluated?
Well, I mean, most of the violence in the world has certainly been men killing other men and taking a lot of other people with them. I mean, I think masculinity is a discourse that tends to try to make itself real through violence, and that I'm interested in this particular kind of violence that I feel like this is kind of anecdotal. Like, I, you know, this isn't something that I can kind of prove, that there was this kind of change in the nature of the violence among the privileged that started, you know, kind of had its first culmination in Columbine, which was a signal event for my generation, you know, which was not the kind of traditional kind of violence that, like, liberalism could account for, which is like, you know, violence that comes out of economic desperation or violence that comes out of like conflicting beliefs about the good life. It wasn't even then violence that could be mapped onto the old hatreds of like race or class or whatever. It was this violence of total like numb vacuity, right? It was the violence of like middle class kids just going and shooting up their schools. And you could figure out a way to say it was about, oh, they were bullied. You know, this is like, this was part of the rise of the bullying discourse. And maybe that was or wasn't true to a certain extent in specific instances. But the normalcy of the kids was what was really terrifying, right? That they, in many ways, just were the able-bodied, privileged white male subjects of the kind of, you know, middle-class suburb of Littleton, Colorado, or whatever. So the kind of violence that this book is interested in, it's the main kind of violence this book's interested in. There are many forms of violence in it. A kind of white middle-class violence that comes out of a kind of vacuum of identity or a kind of cultural poverty where the things that rush in to fill the evacuated privileged subject are misogyny, homophobia, racism, and also this like appropriated discourse of like gangster rap or whatever. And, you know, I think that, you know, this is also about the 90s when there was this discourse of the end of history, when like supposedly like all the enemies of the American empire had been vanquished, right? Like the Berlin Wall had fallen, the Soviet Union had collapsed. There was this idea that there were just going to be like technocratic solutions to the world's problems from there on. I mean, this was a white boomer fantasy or whatever, but it was kind of in the air. And meanwhile, these kids who should have been, you know, the triumphant, privileged kids at the end of history were beating each other unconscious every weekend for kind of no good reason. And the violence really shifted from like, you know, in my lifetime, from like the boys will be boys, like fist fight, fight ends when somebody falls to the ground, to this kind of mixed martial arts overkill where, you know, the fight really started when somebody fell to the ground and that's when everybody was getting kind of stomped unconscious or whatever. So, you know, the book isn't a work of sociology. It's not that I have like an explanatory theory for all of this, but it does want to get at this vacuum that violence fills at the heart of a kind of white male privilege, which I do think has implications for our political present.
To what extent do the expectations that society has for men and the frustration of them play into creating that vacuum? I spoke to a writer who talked about competency as this kind of archetypal American value, this idea that whatever you did it to the best of your abilities, and that that was a kind of moral virtue in itself. I just wonder if that, yeah, is that vacuum like, is it entirely born of privilege or is it also born to a degree of redundancy?
Redundancy in what sense?
Like, suppose redundancy in the sense of having reached the point at which traditional roles are no longer particularly appropriate.
I think it's kind of both. I mean, I think the end of history narrative is interesting in that way, right? Because it part of it was kind of like, well, what do you do now? You kind of have every material thing you could want or whatever. And a lot of the traditional sources of identity, which I'm not like nostalgic for, like I'm not saying we should return to the 1950s. We know what that leads to, right? I mean, that's the Trump fantasy. But a lot of the traditional sources of meaning had been kind of emptied out, like even in a place where I lived. Like, just think about it in terms of the landscape. Like, instead of like, you know, the downtown is replaced with a peripheral mall or strip mall, right? The local businesses are replaced with these franchises, which are the exact same franchises in the exact same order wherever you go, you know, so that if you drive out of Topeka for 30 minutes and you pull off into another town, it's the same Applebee's, Olive Gardens, whatever. So that the landscape's interchangeability really is a kind of phenomenology of redundancy, right? So that eradication of particularity, I think, is part of the kind of vacuum I'm talking about. The language isn't local anymore. It's from television. The manners of dress and address are being borrowed by these white kids from like watching, you know, hip hop videos on BET after school or whatever. So that there is a way in which the landscape of a certain moment of capital and its standardization eradicates any kind of local sources of meaning or value, and then, you know, how is that vacuum filled? I think that vacuum can be filled, is often traditionally filled for men, and particularly white men in America, by violence, misogyny, homophobia. I'm going to define myself by the violent demotion of some other. And part of, like, what's important about James Baldwin's early writing about race is his emphasis on the fact that there's no such thing as white people, right? It's a lie. It's a made-up construct that only exists based upon the demotion of some racist other called, like, the black person, right, or the African-American person. And so there's a sense in which it necessarily creates this vacuum because you've lost, as Baldwin talks about, you've lost the power to define yourself because you've only defined yourself through this racist fantasy of another. Part of what's happening now, I think, with like Trump supporters, for example, I mean, which are not monolithic, there are many different kinds, but is this idea that like there's been a kind of deconstruction of whiteness or a shame about whiteness or whatever, that without there being like a new loving political vocabulary in its place, and then this like charlatan con man comes and gives everybody permission to just be like a racist again, right? And there's this kind of like libidinal discharge. Like, I don't have to be ashamed anymore, and I have a new enemy. I mean, the enemies are like many and varied. The enemies are the anti-Semitic rhetoric of the enemies of the people. That's the media, but obviously the immigration focus is like one of the oldest forms of reviving a kind of hate that can give white people identity. But it's not, you know, Trump supporters, it would be really great if Trump supporters were just economically deprived people who felt left behind, which is what liberalism would lead you to believe, but they're not. I mean, Trump doesn't win because of just poor white rural voters. Trump wins because of college-educated, middle-class white people, too, who are enthralled by the idea that they don't have to apologize anymore for whiteness. They think of themselves as white people. But again, it's that myth of whiteness that can only exist so long as you're detaining families at the border, as long as you have some racialized other that you can define yourself in opposition to.
Trump is a really bum out place to sort of wrap it up.
Yeah. But, well, that's our world.
That description that you had of the homogenization of the American landscape, that point in capitalism, that's a complaint against globalism. It's something that we have here, the death of the high street, the ascendance of Amazon and all that.
Right.
Seems like there are a couple of responses to it. One is, you know, this kind of bougie, I'm only going to buy meat from my local butcher.
Right.
I love crafts. I'm going to spend like huge amounts of money on a hand-tooled leather rucksack. And the other is this kind of Brexit-y isolationist shutting down of everything and like return to nostalgia.
Right.
I suppose it's nostalgia that seems pretty critical and seems pretty dangerous in how you address it.
Yeah.
I wonder if Trump in the US, if I don't know what your perspective on Brexit is, but this kind of analogous, although not as extreme, right-wing populist movement in the UK, whether this kind of regressive conservatism is the triumph of that kind of nostalgia, of a kind of atavism, or whether it's, in your opinion, the pendulum reaching the kind of upper end of its arc before it sort of swings back.
Boy, I really don't know. I mean, I think that we definitely need, and I don't pretend to have it, like a third way, but the two options. I mean, I think these are the two options that we feel stuck with, is either this like elite artisanal simulation of a return to the local, or a populist nostalgia that's a right wing return to some kind of blood and soil discourse. And if those are the only two options, we're truly in trouble, right? And I think that part of the issue is the total failure of the left to be able to produce a third option. And that's what has to happen, because the part of like the Trump supporter that I understand is the part that's like, oh, like, well, you live in New York and you fly on airplanes and you're hurting the environment too. It's just that your hamburger costs $27 and is grass-fed or whatever, whereas like I go to McDonald's and you look down on me. Like, we're equally guilty, but you feel superior. That structure of feeling makes some sense to me, right? Which is why you have a Trump who's like valorized for being stupid and who gets celebrated every time he like serves McDonald's at the White House. It's kind of a permission to be shameless on the topic of shame. I think there has to be a real left vocabulary that's like addressing things like climate and things like inequality, and also positively articulating a vocabulary of like love, possibility, belonging, excitement. Because otherwise, we're just all going to be neocons, right? Which is what's happening a lot now. It's like, you know, we were all like in the U.S., like suddenly like me and all my Marxist friends were like, where's the CIA? Can't the CIA stop this, right? Or it's like talking about like Brexit. It's like now all of a sudden, I feel like I have to uncritically defend the European Union, which is also totally incompatible with my politics, right? So that's like the trap, is that we get trapped in like a Clinton-like neoliberalism because it seems like the only thing we can use to oppose the fascistic regression of the right. And there actually has to be some third way. And the small contribution I feel like literature can make to that is in part by like thinking about the pleasure and the bodily possibilities. This is kind of what 1004 is about, of like harnessing the libidinal for the political, right? Like that's like what my hero John Berger was so involved in. Being a materialist doesn't mean that like you just sit around and debate Soviet theories. Like being a materialist means you love the material world. It means like you see possibilities of pleasure and interconnection and the senses. So I think the one thing literature needs to do is help imagine a libidinally charged, a kind of a politics that's also an erotics, that's also an awakening of the senses, that can be something other than the two modes of ugliness that we're otherwise stuck with.
My thanks to Ben Lerner, and The Topeka School is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Anyone who's travelled on London's Underground network will surely be familiar with the ambitious and heartening Art on the Underground project. Commissions from leading artists scattered around stations across the capital invite the Tube's users, be they tourists or commuters, buskers or TfL employees, to take a moment out to think. It's a venue for art in its purest form.
The latest commission is from artist Larry Achimpong. He'll be redesigning the Underground's iconic logo, a circle with a horizontal line drawn through it, called a roundel, for an exhibition in 70 spots around Westminster Station, at the heart of the UK's political establishment.
Earlier, I caught up with Larry and Eleanor Pinfield, head of Art in the Underground, to learn more about the history of the project and how Larry engaged with a commission destined to be seen by millions.
We all know as we travel about that London Underground, TfL, has a huge effect emotionally, kind of psychologically, as we travel. Day to day, we might not notice that, but over the course of a lifetime, especially for me, someone who was born in London and lived here my whole life, there's that feeling it's completely integral to my psyche. So when I was a kid coming into London, you know, one of the earliest memories I have is looking at the Eduardo Paolozzi works in Tottenham Court Road when I used to come up to the West End. They had such a big effect on me before I knew what art was, certainly, obviously, before I knew who Eduardo Paolozzi was or anything else about that kind of legacy. But I think that commitment to showing amazing artworks or something surprising, something unexpected as you're travelling around really changes how every Londoner has a relationship to the Underground and also to their city. London Underground started from the very early part of the 20th century feeling like it was important as a public sector authority that art and design would be an integral part of how the Underground would develop. That started in the really early 20th century, and there were some amazing artists and designers that were brought in. And I think the privilege of working within that legacy is something that we as the curatorial team, but also the artists, really respond to, that sense that artists can change how we see a city. And we've been doing that in London for over 100 years. We do it slightly differently now to how they were doing it in the early part of the 20th century. And in a way, we're actually maybe even more conceptual, more avant-garde. It was very avant-garde in the early part of the 20th century, but it maybe had a little bit more of a... Artists were often asked to do posters that were sort of like, these are how the doors close and that kind of thing. So, you know, you've got Man Ray doing amazing artworks about travelling about by tube. But for us, you know, and having a chance to work with someone like Larry and other artists, we can also bring that wider kind of conceptual, social angle to the tube. You know, how do you feel as you're travelling around? Who's represented in the city? And that's a really important part of the work we're doing with Larry, but also with a lot of other artists this year.
I always think about that, Larry, as I look at the art on the Underground. It falls into a difficult category because people use the tube all day and all night now, from commuters who experience, you know, something quite close to hell on earth down there to everyone else who just uses it to get around. And the art sits in this very interesting and quite complicated position relative to all of these people and their different experiences. When you were kind of approaching this commission, were you thinking about making something that needed to be almost in your face or something that people could catch from their peripheral vision and think about? Because that also seems to reflect what you're saying about this shift from quite prosaic, this is how the doors shut, mind the gap, visual communication, to something that's maybe meant to echo a bit more in the mind, to provide food for thought.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Augustine. I mean, to answer your question, the approach to working with the roundels and thinking about the space in terms of Westminster certainly came into this understanding that, yeah, you're not making something to simply sit within a space that people will kind of gawk at. You know, you're thinking about different types of periphery. You're thinking about different types of relationships that people are having as they're moving through the space. People who are either working on the Underground or people who are simply just moving through day by day. for us, when we were working on the other projects, and when I say us, I mean I do have a team of people who work with me, Nefertiti Eboshi-Shandorf, who assisted on this project and has worked on the Relic Traveller project, which I'm sure we'll get into later on, and Wumi Alao-Esabakon, who assisted with the other designs. There was certainly this understanding that we're creating something conceptual that, of course, you look at it, you can get in a bit deeper, and there's something beyond the use of colours and even symbols. But then also the understanding is that it should work in relation to somebody actually moving as well. So we were very relaxed in terms of our approach, and I've been more and more open in my practice in wanting to communicate with the wider public, and of course being able to show outside of a gallery space into an area where there are literally millions of people passing through month by month. I mean, that's an exciting prospect, really.
It seems like a really interesting commission because it's public art, but it's not public art, is it? It's not quite public art somehow. It seems to do something other than commemorate or memorialise or be a spectacle or be something that's there in the middle of a park to go and look at. It's something that people catch out of the corner of their eye. And as you say, plants a seed of thought. Curatorially, is that something that you're always hanging on to?
I mean, I think that's a really interesting debate as to what is public art, which we could probably have an entire session on separately. I think it's almost a structural challenge for us. We don't have the space to put a big sculpture in one place. You know, it's a busy working system. That's both the kind of curatorial protocol that we're excited by, but also it does have some constraints that come with it. So when we think about it, every commission, as we started off, is how do you intervene in a busy system that's occupied, which is very different from the statue in the park or some other model like that. So we often, as we're starting our debates with artists, as we're setting up the commission, it's all about site specificity. How do we make it relevant to the architecture, but also the social, the psychological aspect of that space? What are the sight lines? How might people be feeling? How will they be experiencing it? I mean, Larry put that really well. It's a big station, actually, Westminster. So as people are travelling through, they will be glancing it out of their eye. But what I love about this commission is because it's small, but it's everywhere through the station. So that actually does create, as we were saying, this kind of subconscious reference to what you're seeing. And I think one of the reasons our works are so different in the space is that it's already a very visually stimulating space, the underground, as opposed to the park or the statue. Arguably, there's still lots going on, but in terms of advertising and visual material and the numbers of people, especially in that kind of rush hour scenario. So it's almost as though I would understand it when people see things, it actually isn't trying to sell them anything. It's almost that thing that maybe comes in first to the brain when you're not really expecting to see art necessarily. That sense of, this is just something that seems to be catching my eye and I don't know why. And that's what I hope people are like, I wonder what that means, or I wonder why that's here in Westminster. I wonder why we suddenly got these flag-like colours in the middle of Westminster, but I can't think why. And for some people, they might know already. They might see those colours and immediately it will resonate something with them. They might know about the history of Afrofuturism, they might know about Pan-Africanism, they might have that already, or they might just be like, I wonder what that is. So I think it is very different because it's intervening in social structures. So I suppose in that sense, is it different to public art? You know, there is other forms of public art or social practice that would seek to do that. I think what's interesting for us is we do it in such a highly visible way. You know, when you imagine the classic social practice project, you might only be maybe in a great deal of depth, but you might only actually be engaging with a certain community group in a certain way. And what is amazing about this is we can bring it to the whole of London. Not only will Larry's works be in Westminster, but we were just talking about the poster that links to it will be in every single station. You know, that's 270 stations. And again, Larry's work is so graphic, so recognisable. Again, to people, that will be a big statement in itself that it's in 270 sites and it's not acting as advertising. And I think that's where the kind of richness and the excitement comes from.
Did you feel that, Larry? Did you have this awareness that your audience is in some ways going to have its, not necessarily its visual guard down, but is going to be consuming visual material critically as a consequence of this other stimulus that surrounds them on the tube?
I felt that there was a possibility that that would happen. And again, as somebody who's used the other tube since I was a kid, both living in a part of the other city, East London, Bethnal Green, to like all the way out in Dagenham, you know, again, your journey, your process of movement is inspired by these containers that you're kind of moving through certain points that connects a station to another station, changing and so on. So that was certainly something that flowed through my mind as we were going through the developmental process of the work. But I think something else that had already even prepped me before working with London Underground was working with Somerset House. So we worked on a flag project in 2017. And at that same point in time, I was actually developing the Relic Traveller project. And I was script writing for two films. And within these two films, one of the other characters, the Relic Traveller, was going to have these patch logos, specific designs that contain Pan-African colours and so on. And incidentally, I felt that these images would actually work really well, potentially as flags. So kind of already working within that type of environment of flags standing on top of quite a recognised monument in Somerset House, by then moving to the London Underground, working for Art on the Underground, I think actually it felt perhaps a bit more like a playground in that, okay, we've got a little bit more to play with, because as was mentioned earlier, you know, there are constraints with working with, you know, the other roundel. You have to work within a specific space, but then you're working with multiple roundels, right? And so then the potential to create a range of designs, perhaps instead of just one, then becomes an even bigger prospect. And then when you're thinking about the poster and the imagery there and its relationship coming back to those roundels, you begin to dream perhaps a bit more, really. So, yeah.
We should clarify. So the roundel is this circle with a horizontal line through it, which will be very familiar to everyone who's ever travelled on or, you know, even seen the sign for the tube. It seems like this commission that you've engaged with sits at the intersection of what you were describing, this old, very designed relationship between the London Underground and graphic imagery, and then this newer conceptual thing, insofar as you're taking this icon, deconstructing it. Did it feel like, in part, a design project?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think for me, what was kind of strange about that is I've never really seen myself as someone who is a designer or works in that way. Of course, I develop concepts and I work on the fly, and there isn't a particular medium that I would say, yeah, that's just my thing. So I think having that approach to making allowed me to perhaps, again, think openly about working on this project. Again, it was very similar a few years ago with Somerset House. I'd never, you know, designed a flag before. But I think in terms of the openness of the other practice, that allowed me to feel a bit more comfortable. But certainly as we kind of go into thinking about the other history, even the use of colours in relation to the roundel, these are things that I wanted to research further and think about in relation to perhaps a conversation that is not only a little bit more different and connects to additionally plenty of people within the UK, but galvanises what I feel a very kind of pertinent conversation at this particular social and contemporary moment in our time.
So obviously, as we've established, it's in Westminster, where all sorts of bizarre things are currently going on. Let's try not to mention the B word, but there is this sense of disruption in the UK at the moment, and I don't mean disruption in the kind of Zuckerberg sense. Eleanor, what are your reflections on that? How did Larry seem like the right artist for this place at this time?
As we've been developing the programme, we've also been taking curatorial sort of overviews for the year. So across this whole year in 2019, exactly, we won't mention the B word, but we were thinking about the idea of uncertainty and the sense both of that feeling sort of individually, but also collectively and politically, that sense of uncertainty and not knowing when we are. So our whole theme for this year is this idea of being on edge and crossing thresholds and not being entirely clear where we are. But we sort of wanted to expand that to think about that sense when you cross a threshold, you know, who's allowed to belong and who doesn't belong, who belongs in the city, who's considered an outsider, and how can we maybe look around more utopian visions of the city. So that's been a driving force for us this whole year. And we've done some really wonderful other commissions throughout the year, working with artists who've explored that from different points of view, including with Laure Povos this summer, who did amazing work, thinking a lot about the more the European Londoner, but the sense of a sort of very playful meditation on what it means to be travelling around the city, being underground in a brilliant way. And some other works, Elisa Nissenbaum, Denzel Forrester, have made a brilliant works for us at Brixton. And from that basis, I mean, Larry's practice completely fits within that wider question. Who's allowed to belong? Whose histories are represented? So for us, it felt as we were thinking about curatorially which artists we want to work with. You know, we'd been long time fans of Larry's practice through his amazing individual works and collaborations with David Blandy. And this felt like the right moment for us to ask Larry if he wanted to work with us, to bring that idea of who's the city for and whose histories can be forgotten. So it's that wider social question rather than a direct challenge to the political establishment. It's that softer, who's allowed to be part of the city, and we should place that in Westminster right now because that's where those questions are being asked.
It's an important question, and I think one, certainly from within London, that it feels like maybe London reflects on more than others. I was interested, you mentioned that idea of the European Londoner yeah. as a kind of set of Londoner. I don't have that much experience in other capital cities, so I don't know how, to what extent that's true, but London definitely has always been this place that transcends the nation in which it's set. As geopolitics have shifted over the last 60 plus years, my question to you both is, just to conclude, to what extent do you think this art on the underground, as a project, as an idea, as a vision of how art could be and where it could be placed, how specific is it to London, do you think? And how much does it provide a model for other cities around the world for art engagement?
I'd say personally, from a point of view of coming from working class background, having experienced, you know, poverty and so on, art within the sense of going to galleries was introduced to me far later on than many of my peers. And the underground is something that is way more accessible than something like a gallery. So already you're creating a space where there are far more people who are going into or going through various environments or using certain systems that they just wouldn't otherwise. So I feel like I can speak on those terms that naturally, where there are plenty more people travelling through certain spaces, they're likely to connect with something way more than spaces that they are excluded from. So for me, I think way more than anything, that was what pulled me into wanting to do this project. I'm not saying that I don't make work that goes into gallery spaces, I still do, but I have certainly been way more excited at the prospect of connecting with way more people. When that happens, it feels like there is an actual potential conversation that is happening, and one that doesn't exclude, which again is very important to me based on where, you know, I've kind of come from and so on. And so being able to convey messages without contradicting yourself as to, oh well, it's only certain people who are going to hear that sound or that voice, goes a long way. It really does.
Internationally, I think we've been hugely influential. London Underground has from the past in terms of seeing how you can bring artists and designers in with a lot of integrity. But I think what's so interesting that we do, bit of a niche area, other art programmes on transit models internationally. They tend to do more permanent works, you know, maybe things in big stations, happening a lot in Asia, in North America. What's so exciting about what we do is that we often do these temporary projects, like this will be up for 3 months, but it will have such an effect for that period, and it allows us to engage and practice in a completely different way to when you only do big permanent pieces that are integrated into architecture. It allows us to engage in contemporary art practice, but doing it in a really, really public forum. And that, to me, I think, is very influential. And we, being part of TFL as a permanent team of curators within TFL, you know, how lucky are we to have that? Because it also means we can passionately re-engage with these topics time and time again. So again, in a lot of public art, you might have consultants brought in to do a piece and then they go away again. And we're the opposite model of that. And I think that allows us to build up relationships with incredible artists like Larry and others, and to really bring that together to present something completely unique to London.
Thanks to Eleanor Pinfield and Larry Atchimpong in conversation with Augustine. And Larry's commission for Westminster Station will be revealed on the 14th of November. And you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. I really enjoyed the show, Aug. Great hanging out with you Sunday as ever. Let's thank our pals behind the glass. That was edition 540 of the Monocle Weekly.
Yeah, I produced it, and our studio managers were Maylie Evans and Nora Hull.
And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But the time being is goodbye from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Augusta Mancellari.
Goodbye.
Bye.